pretty much for the organizer for invited me and Professor Villas who asked me to prepare these lectures. And as you noticed, the original title was Modeling Large Complex Systems. I changed the title. I hope Vigyal didn't intend, basing on his morning lecture, didn't intend my lecture as a penitence for you. I tried to just speak about much less subject than modeling large complex systems, which are modeling ecological systems. And this has to have, of course, with the importance of individuality. So, of course, there is a long tradition of modeling ecological systems. The work began with Lotka and Volterra some nearly 100 years ago. And this is what many of you know already with the predator-prey models. And there are some landmark books on the subject, which is, for example, this one by May, which is really a very important book in the ecological modeling. It appeared some 40 years ago, but still being published and still as important. So the subject of my talk is not that broad. I'd be happy if I can just make few very broad assumptions about very general problems. So general problems in ecology, very general problem, maybe too broad, is, for example, how many species do you have? And what's the abundance is? Why do you see this many species in this place and this many species in this place? Other kind of very general problems are the population of the food webs. You know that the whole ecology is about who eats whom. And so this makes a graph, and the population of this graph is one of these important problems in ecology. And finally, you can ask why species are distributed as they are in nature. Why do you see more of these species here than here? These are the kind of questions I try to address, at least the third one, and the first one, and the third one. So let's begin with very broad sentences. As you know, Dobzhansky said, and this is a very famous subject, that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of the evolution. But again, we have to see what do we mean by evolution. Not all of us mean the same thing by evolution. Even though the basic principles of evolution are accepted by most of us, by all of us. So, one strong belief in evolution and its application to ecology is adaptation. That whatever we see around us has been selected because it's adapted to perform a very specific function, and it's adapted pretty well. For example, if you look at the biodiversity problem, you see that you have this many species. You see, oh, each species I see is very well adapted to its niche. If you look at the spatial dispersion of a species, you can make the same sentence, say that if you see more of these species in this place, it's because they are well adapted. The conditions in this place are very good. So they are well adapted to this space. So this is what I call the adaptationist program. It has been criticized. The most harsh attack on the adaptationist program was this famous paper of Gould and Levantine, and saying that there are much more to natural selection than just adaptation. You have traits are correlated, but you select for one trait, you can have influences on other traits. As Vigia was saying, selection may act or acts at different levels. And again, there are not a big agreement about how many levels of selection we have. And one thing which is also very important is that we have something called genetic drift. And genetic drift, of course, was known the founding father of population genetics back in the 1920s. And it became an important subject mostly due to Kimura in the 1970s. Kimura was claiming, or that was his belief, that most of the evolution we see are neutral. Most of the genes are mutated, have no selective advantage or disadvantage. They are just happens because of the mutations and neutrality. And many other things. So the picture is just what we call the standards. Standards is this place when you have to connect when you are building a dome. This is the place you have to connect to arches. And then between these two arches you have a space. And so this is why it gave the name of this paper, the standard of San Marco. Okay. So I try to show that it's possible to have, before going to deterministic adaptationist causes, maybe we can look at purely random and neutral phenomena, just to see if it's possible to explain some patterns just assuming neutrality and randomness. And what I'm trying to convince you is that very often when we say random or neutral, it's supposed to be boring, homogeneous, nothing special should happen, everything should be homogeneous, well distributed, and so on. This would be true for continuous models very often. But it's something which is very specific to biology, which is the discreteness, the individuality. And the fact is that you don't have 1.5 molecules, you have either one molecule or two molecules. And this is what we call discreteness, and its importance has been stressed many times. First, maybe by Mendel himself, that the work of Mendel showing that the hereditary information is quantified, is discrete, and now we call it gene. And this is what saved the evolutionary theory. Because if we are using just the blending theory as it was used to back in the 19th century, we couldn't explain at all the evolution. So of course, being discrete is important. What I'm going to show you is that maybe it's important in places where we don't expect it. Basically. And I'm just going to speak about these two different subjects, which are going to make two parts of my talk. The first one is about the spatial distribution. And the second part of the tool, and do you hear me? I have this intuition of fluctuation noise.
Is that thing working now? It's working? You can go back to the...
Is that working? Okay. Okay, so the first part of the talk is about the spatial distribution. And the second part of the talk is about the biodiversity. And both of them, we do see patterns. And I'll try to see or to show that what happens if only we assume randomness. I'm not telling that randomness will explain everything, but I'm trying to say that even by just assuming randomness, we can see some nice patterns. Okay, so first part of my talk, spatial distribution. The pictures you are seeing here is the distribution of planktons. On the left figures, you have the distribution of planktons at the scale of the planet, on the right side at the scale of our bay, and what you see is that distribution, of course, is not homogeneous, and you can go down to different scales, to the scale of kilometers, or so on, and you see that the distribution is not flat, it's not homogeneous. You have some pattern. And what you can ask is, can we have some vague idea about this kind of distributions? Is there anything in common between the distribution of planktons and, for example, the distribution of trees in a tropical forest? Of course, there are two very different species. And making these kind of assumptions can be considered as bold. But it's a very important, both from a fundamental point of view and from a practical point of view, it's very important if we could have some very general rules for the patterns we can observe. And of course, I mean, it's fundamental because that's how we understand ecology. It's of practical importance if you are making fisheries and you want to know how much fish you can take from this part of the Mediterranean Sea or that part. So during the last 20 years, there has been a huge rise in this subject, in this field. And now it's, you know, when their field increases, they develop new terms, they invent new terms. So the terms now for discussing this subject is called metapopulation biology or metapopulation ecology or these kind of things. But the whole thing is that, can we have some general rules about the dispersion of species? So as I'm going to stay at a very general level, let me just say what I say by patterns. I'm just using a very general classification of patterns. On the right side, you see what you have in human plantations, which is a regular pattern. On the left side, you have what we call a patchy distribution, that you see species more concentrated in some areas than in others. And then in the middle, you have what you would get for a pure, what we call Poissonian process. You take some beads, you spill them on the board, and in the middle, you have what we call a random Poissonian distribution. So how can we quantify that? You divide your space into squares, and you count the number of individuals in each square. So you have a table of numbers, and then you can compute the mean of this number, and then you can compute also the variance or the standard deviation of these numbers. And then you make the ratio of the variance over the mean, and if the variance over the mean is 1, you have this kind of distribution, which is, for me, this is what I call a homogeneous distribution. Of course, this never happens in nature. This only happens in human plantations. But very often, what we observe is this kind of distribution where the variance over the mean is much bigger than 1, and you see species concentrated in one place, mostly, and not so much in the other places. So let me just give you some examples before getting to the heart of the subject. For example, here you see microbial predator-prey systems. You just take some predator, which is a Dictyostelium, many of you are familiar with, and you mix them with bacteria. And after some time, you see this kind of patterns. Here you have only predators, and in the Black Sea in the middle, you have only bacteria. And even though at the beginning you mix them very homogeneously, very soon, this is the kind of pattern you observe. And it's not only in this experimental system we can see it. In fact, everywhere people have looked at in the ecological community, they have seen that the distribution of species are always clustered, always patchy. So not all the people use the same kind of quantifications. They have many different rules to quantify patchy distributions, but it all comes back to what I was saying. And so if you look at the microbial system, like planktons, at insects, at mammals, and plant species, wherever people have looked, they have never found. There was a review some 20 years ago about 2,000 species in all of these kingdoms, and all of these species were spread in patchy distributions. So the question is, why don't we see the homogeneous distribution? Why do we see always patchy distribution like that? So as I said, the first explanation, this common sense explanation, is that, of course, nature is not homogeneous. You have lakes, rivers, slopes, you have gradient of pH and temperature and everything. So it's normal that people would, or individuals, would go to the place which is best for them and not to the other places. So this is the basic ecological explanation for these patchy distributions. The patchiness is just a reflection of the non-homogeneous nature of... Please.
So what is the scale of the patchiness? I mean, does it permit to all scales?
So, yeah. I mean, if you have a pure random process, it doesn't depend on the scale. If it's a patchy distribution, then of course the scale at which you look at is important. The variance over the mean is going to change, and we'll see some examples of that very soon. The variance over the mean will depend on the scale at which you are looking at. So this is an important problem, and of course it's an important test for what I'm going to say. So the first explanation is the heterogeneity of the nature, and the second explanation is that group behaviors. We know that some animals have social behaviors, and if you see this kind of patchiness, you don't say that it's because of the environment or something else. You know that they are together because of some social interactions. So these are the two broad class of answers for how do we explain patchiness in nature. On the other hand, as I said, wherever people have looked, they have seen patchiness. And we could ask, okay, of course, nobody is going to contest that this kind of tree which grows here is not going to grow in the North Pole. But beyond this classical explanation, can we go to some very basic facts? If we see that patchiness is present everywhere, can we have a broad explanation of what may be the cause of this patchiness? So, something fundamental about life, what is fundamental about life? birth and death, and of course duplications. These are what you would define life. And what is particular about this phenomenon, again, it has to do with individuality, is that when you duplicate, you go from one individual to two individuals, never to 1.2 individuals. And when you die, you go from one individual to zero individuals. So this is the first fact of the life. And the second fact of the life is that the new organism, which is the result of duplication of an old organism, always appears close to its parent. So these are very basic rules, and what I want to show is that just by combining these two rules, you can get very complex patterns which are not homogeneous, and we are, and of course, they are always patchy. So let's consider how do we explain. I mean, if I was a physicist coming from, for example, diffusion of heat, how should I explain life with based on these two facts? I would see an equation for the variation of the concentration of the species, for example, how many species I have per mile in this area. And so this term is just the migration of the species. I can suppose that individuals are just moving randomly. And this is the term taking into account birth and death. The birth rate is alpha and the death rate is mu. I'm not going to bore you too much with the equation, but this is very much what we call, it's very similar to what we have in physics, which is called the heat equations. And you know the basic fact of heat, especially if you take the birth rate equal to the death rate, this term disappears, then you really have what you have, what we call a heat equation. And the heat equation is what? Is that you know that if you put a hot body in contact with a cold body, after some time, both bodies are at some middle temperature. So diffusion by itself is just going to homogenize whatever you have. So if you use these kind of equations, what you would expect for especially in this case, when the birth and death are equal, and it's always the same for if they are not, what you would expect is that the distribution of species is going to be homogeneous. This is what we are most used to it. But these people, there was a paper in Nature some 10 years ago. Instead of using these equations, they just took Brownian particles, which are capable of dying and duplicating. You know, you take a Brownian particle, it's moving, and then at some times the Brownian particle duplicates, and then at some times the Brownian particle dies. And instead of writing mean field equations like that, they just simulated the system, and what you see is the exact reverse of what I was explaining by these equations. At the beginning of the time, you just mixed everybody in a very homogeneous way, and then time flow. By just playing these games, particles move randomly, and randomly they die, and randomly they duplicate. And what you see is that after some time, instead from their very homogeneous pattern, you go and get to a very heterogeneous pattern and patchiness. So the paper, when it was published, they were arguing that maybe these kind of phenomena are behind, for example, the patchiness we see in the planktons. Planktons are one of the first systems who have been studied for this patchiness. And how can we understand? Yes?
Is this similar to Alan Turing's?
No, it's very different from the Turing's model. You'll see. I'll continue. Yes?
So if you go back to this equation, yeah. So if you just take alpha minus n to be some constant, it actually also tells you that this is a kind of, all the particles are trying to go towards the higher concentration. So basically, your kappa C term will make it go towards. Okay,
no, you're right. If alpha minus mu, for example, is positive, the population will grow. But again, you can define, even at each time, you take a picture of your populations and you ask, is this population patchy or not? And as we'll see, there is no big difference between alpha bigger than mu or alpha equal to mu. I mean, they are both described by the same statistical equations. The only difference is that it makes the events even sharper to use this regime. But you'll see, in fact, the experimental system I'm going to show you is in the other regime you were speaking about. So how to understand that? Let's suppose that we just play a very basic random game. I have a 96 well plate, and in each well, I put 5 bacteria. And now I play a simple game that all bacteria have the same probability of duplicating, that the same probability of dying. At each time step, somebody is going to die at random, and somebody is going to duplicate at random. And so the rule of the game is the number of individuals, the number of individuals in a well can change the number. You go from n to n plus 1 by just this probability, which is the same, going up or going down is the same. So now you do a numerical simulation of this very simple rules, and what you see after some time is this situation, that in some worlds you have a huge number of particles, and in other worlds you don't have any, or you have a very few particles. And if you do this numerical simulation, you would see that in average, the average number of individuals in this world, it always remains the same. It's the five you put at the beginning. But what you call the variance is going linearly up. And if we just play this game in your computer, it can go to very high values. So you see that only the fact that we have put here that we go from n to n plus 1 or n minus 1 will dramatically change the behavior you're expecting, and you would see high patchiness in these very simple systems. And of course, this is the kind of thing you can exactly solve by using this, the master equations you are going to use. But now you can ask, okay, but in reality, people are not confined to somewhere. People can diffuse from one world to the other. So what happens if you remove the wall between the worlds? So of course, from a high density area, individuals are going to diffuse to low density area. Can this smoothen the patchiness? The answer is no. If you now include, you use the same kind of equations, you now add the migration between worlds, you can show that in one or two dimensions, which is the relevant dimensions of the life, you cannot smoothen the patchiness, and the system always gets patchy and more patchy. And of course, this is the kind of things you can do exactly by math and compute everything, compute correlations, whatever. But what is important is that as soon as you forget about continuous models, I mean, using continuous models or neglecting something which is very important, which are fluctuations, and fluctuations are very important when you put individuality. So you cannot use in this kind of system the continuous approach you are very much used in ecological modeling because of that, because you are neglecting fluctuations, and this gives you a totally wrong picture. So the game I played in this world, it was a game, there was nothing controlling the resources. You could have many bacteria in a well, etc. You can make it much more realistic, put resource limitations and so on. It doesn't change anything. You will always get patchiness. This is one of the examples, again, we solved exactly. And this is an example, I'm going back, you don't see the picture is not good. There was a very famous book published in 2001 about nodal ecology by a guy called Hubble. So he was proposing this kind of model I'm going to speak about for the tropical forest. He's an ecologist from tropical forest. And in tropical forest, what is the limiting resource is space. If, for example, you divide again your forest into rectangles, you know that in each rectangle, the total number of trees is fixed. You cannot get more than, for example, 100 trees per, 100 square meter. These trees can be of all different species. I have put them in different colors. So what you have is that the total number of individuals is fixed, but of course each species can have more or less of individuals. And now you can again play a very neutral game that everyone, whatever its color, has the same probability of dying or duplicating. The duplication happens when an existing tree dies, it's replaced by the seed of another tree. So this is how one individual duplicates. You can play these neutral games, and again, you can show that you have the same kind of patchiness. So this is a numerical simulation. You take, for example, one of the species, let's say the green species, you put it in black dots, and put all the other species in white dots. You begin with a very homogeneous distribution of your dots, and you play just this game of somebody dies, and it's replaced by the seed of another one, and you end up with this very patchy distribution of, for example, your palm trees or something. So even when resources are very limited, just these random games is going to give you patchiness by the very basic facts of life, going from 1 to 1 plus 1 and immigration games. And again, this is something you can, again, solve exactly. This is not that hard. And you can, of course, all the numerical simulations, you can explain them very well with whatever you have computed for your correlations and so on. So, OK. I don't know if I have convinced you that just putting that is enough. I guess the best thing to convince is experimental proof that we do, in fact, have that, that just by putting some bacteria or some microbes in a petri dish, we can get this clustering phenomenon. So this is what we are going to do. Of course, people have done that very often in the natural systems. For example, they go to an island in the tropical places. For 2 months, there are 80 people counting all the species of trees they can find. It takes a long time. And then you can compare that to what you expect. So this is the kind of observations we have. But for observation, many things are lacking. We don't know the rate of duplication, the rate of death, how the seeds are migrated, or so on. So even though people have looked at the pattern of distribution of species based on this kind of theories, you can always say, OK, maybe this kind of theories, maybe the pattern was provoked by some other causes we don't know about. So the best thing is to go to an experimental system. And the experimental system, of course, what we are asking from this experimental system is that it has to be perfectly homogeneous, because we want to exclude anything connected to natural heterogeneity. The other thing we want to do is to have enough time. I mean, if you are looking at the tropical forest, of course, the generation time of the tropical forest is much beyond the lifetime of a researcher. So what we do like to have is a system which is, of course, extended in time, extended in space. This is also the important fact. And it also allows easy data collection. I should have put easy in quotes. But anyway, this is what we would like from the system. And this is the most important thing that we are asking in this very simple system we are making. We want to measure all the parameters, just not to let any room for any kind of other explanations. So this is what I'm going to speak about. And of course, when you put all of that together, the only kind of experiment you can do is on microbial systems, which have all of this here. So the microbial system is just a petri dish. A petri dish is 50 millimeter wide, which is infinitely wide for this big dictyostelium. And of course, as many of you know, dictyostelium is a unicellular eukaryote. And it has been used in many other systems. Here we are just going to use it as a individual going around. We feed these dictyosteliums by the medium. We don't let it eat bacteria. So the quantity of food is always fixed and homogeneous. And we have division times we can exactly count. So how do we collect data? In fact, the data collection, as I said, it's easy, but it's not that easy. You take your petri dish and you make 1,000 photographs of your petri dish by an objective, and then each photograph you detect all the dictyosteliums you have by your image analysis program, and then you can make a table of the position of each dictyostelium here. So you know the position, you know the map of the species distribution at each time step. Usually we do one time step per generation time. And so you just let the system evolve. You just, at the beginning, let some dictyostelium on your petri dish, and you let them evolve, duplicate, run around, and so on. And what you observe is that very soon, after a few generations, this is the kind of distribution you get, even though at the beginning the distribution was perfectly homogeneous. And if you do numerical simulations, of course, you get very similar patterns. If I take the same number of dictyostelium, there are 70,000 in this picture. If I spread them randomly, this is the kind of picture I should get. And this is not, of course, what I get. I get this very patchy distribution with a variance to mean, very high variance to mean, here is computed on the scale of one photograph. And I come back to the important fact of the scale. So, as I said, everything has to be measurable. And so we have only two parameters. They don't die, they only grow. And we can just measure the number of dictyostelium we have per time, and we see that they have a nice growth curve. So we can just deduce the growth rate of the dictyostelium, and we can also watch them moving around, and just by just watching them moving around, we can say what we call the diffusion coefficient, what's the randomness in movement. So both of these quantities are perfectly measurable. And now, what you would do is that if the system is as neutral as I said, you have to have some prediction about what we call the correlation function. The correlation function is nothing strange, it's just you take all pairs of dictyostelions and you have 70,000 dictyostelions in petri dish, you take all pairs of them and compute the distances between all of these dictyostelions and you make the histogram of that. So this histogram is what we call the correlation functions, normalized correctly. And so if everything was, as I said, due to normal phenomena, the histogram of the pair distributions, the distance distribution, the correlation function, should be a very nice function like that. And now if you compare the observed distribution of the dictyosteliums at different times and compare them to what you predicted, you see that they are very similar. And I insist that in this model we don't have any adjustable parameter. Everything is measured directly in the petri dish. So the complex pattern I'll show you can very well be explained just by these very basic facts. The basic facts are not very useful to ecologists which go to the field, because measuring the histogram is very easy when you are in your lab. When you go to nature, it's a much harder world. So in fact, the best thing to measure if you go to the field is to measure what we call the variance over the mean ratio. As I said, you divide your space into rectangles, you count your individual in the rectangles. But here, what is important is that this variance over the mean should depend on the size of on the scale of your rectangles, and you can compute what is the expected variance to mean ratio. Again, it's a nice function which you can compute. And you compare that, you put now all your experiments together, and you see that all your experiments are following this very nice variance to mean ratio as a function of the time or as a function of the size of your rectangles. And this has been done in many different experimental conditions and so on. So, as I said, again, when we go to look at the distribution of species, we see complex patterns. Maybe these complex patterns are not due to deterministic causes. Maybe they are just due to this random phenomenon I'm describing. And the random phenomenon is just you go from 1 to 1 plus 1 randomly. And of course, if you take the invariant into account, you forget about the continuous model, then you would get kind of species distribution. So when you go to your field, in fact, you shouldn't expect a random distribution. You should expect something. If you have a mean of quantifying the patchiness, the normal patchiness should be much above the Poissonian distributions. So now you have to compare your observation not to the homogeneous solution, which is the one you would expect based from continuous conditions, but from what you would get from a neutral model. And then if you observe that you have more patchiness that you can observe, you can explain with the neutral model, you see, okay, now I have some deterministic causes. Maybe the environment, maybe the social interaction. But if your observation is close to what the neutral theory predicts, maybe you don't have to go to this complex model, complex explanation, which are very specific to each species. I mean, each species has its own rules of how it's adapted, how it behaves socially, and so on. But maybe we just don't need, for the very basic level, this complex rule. I mean, and we can't answer that before measuring what's the real patchiness and compare it to what we get from the neutral model. Okay. So I will end the first part of my talk.
Could it be that the environment still plays a role, but it's a second order, which
So we try in the petri dish to keep the environment. The environment is what we how do we feed them? So we try to keep this environment as constant as possible. If you look at the diffusion time of the molecules and the diffusion time of the deuteriums, the diffusion time is much smaller than the generation time of the deuterium. So for us, the environment is homogeneous. Maybe there are some strange facts we hadn't explained. They are here. But what I'm saying is that all the patterns I see, I can explain that with just the randomness. If I had more patchiness, maybe I should take into account what you are saying. Or maybe many of you know that deuterium has a social life. And maybe, even though they are not in starvation, maybe they have some interactions. What we are saying is that no, they don't have an interaction because we can expect everything by this very simple model with no adjustable parameter. If we had more patchiness, then maybe we should use this kind of social interactions or environments or so on. But my point is that what in this simple experimental system I see, I can explain all of them with a very basic rules.
Does the size and shape of the petri dish also have been
tried? No, I mean, this would be very time consuming, but you're right. When you show your experiments, everything is so fine and so nice. When you're doing them, of course, it's not that easy. So no, I at the beginning, maybe I tried to do it linearly, but no, I moved to the circular petri dishes.
So the second question was that Alec Deering did also produce patchiness.
Yeah,
starting from very homogeneous.
Yeah, but he had some rules about, the work of Alec Deering was about morphogenesis, I guess you are referring to.
Yeah.
So they had an autocatalytic system that X is going to amplify Y, and otherwise they had, this was the very important rule, that one has to amplify the others, and they have to have different diffusion coefficients.
Yeah.
So here we don't use any kind of we don't use any, this kind of explanation about we have only one species and we don't observe any kind of other molecules.
When you had the predictor ray, did you mix them together and they produce the patchiness?
So I didn't explain. I mean, this is very usual. You explain just the best part of your experiment and not the worst part. So I don't know about the predator system. It's too complicated. We need much more measurements. And the predator prey system is very complicated. So I don't know how to answer it. But the project began because I wanted to say something about predator prey, but it's a very complicated system. Yeah?
Would you have the same results if your 1 to 1 plus 1 was given by something less than birth? For instance, two cells sticking to each other randomly from time to time.
And then moving together?
Yes, or staying together for a while.
I think that if you have conservation rules like that, that you have 1 plus 1 and then you get again 1 plus 1, you couldn't, I have to think about it. But I don't think you can get this kind of behavior. You would take normal diffusions. But I'm not sure about my answer, I have to think about it. But I think this should be the answer.
In the Turing model, the spatial scales are given by a mix of the diffusion coefficients and the activator range and the inhibitor range.
Right.
Here your only natural scale is the diffusion coefficient and the inverse of the growth rate.
Exactly.
How does the scale of patchiness compare to that?
So, as I said, this is a system where the population grows, so the patchiness is also growing. But what we can do is to predict exactly the rate of increase in patchiness, and this is this is this slide, in fact. This is the rate of increase of patchiness as a function of time. Because this population is growing. I could also make some populations which are stable, but you have a problem of removing the dead bodies, and this is you would perturbate too much the system if you try to do this kind of stuff. So this system is only of growing populations, which is mathematically exactly the same as the stable system. But as you see, the scale of the patchiness is growing, and of course it happens that sometimes that the scale of patchiness becomes comparable to the scale of the petri dish. We stop the experiment much before.
Yes, but even before that, it appears that these are all exponentially growing curves here.
Yeah.
Both of these. Which means that you have decoupled the system from the natural scale, which is your square root of V over whatever the rate is.
Okay, so you're right. I mean, there is for example, if you look at this quantity, this is measured in natural scale. But as you say, this quantity in natural scale is a growing quantity. You're absolutely right. So again, in each neutral situation, you have to make your own rules. This is the simplest neutral model you can think of. But you can, of course, add some more complicated resource limits or something to the model. You had also a question?
So what is the shape of the particles? The shape of the experimental particles, I mean, they're long, right?
The Dieterstellian?
Yeah.
No, I mean, they're shapeless. I mean, it depends. The shape is what you see in this picture. This is the shape of Dieterstellian, so you see all kinds of shapes.
And they can move, right?
Oh, they move a lot, yeah.
If they can move, then actually, even if there is a conservation law, even if their concentration is conserved, they can still form patches.
But you need something else. If they just move around, you have Brownian particles.
If they just move around, yes, they have Brownian particles, but if they're concentrated and they move, so they are like active particles, active Brownian particles. And if you actually look at the concentration fluctuations of active Brownian particles.
So that's all the thing. What do you mean by active? That you have to put something in your Brownian motions. And then, if you put this something in the Brownian motions, of course, you have also have some predictions about what you would get about the correlation functions. So what I'm saying is that, not using what you're saying, active or something, I'm just using these two very basic facts, I totally explain the correlation function, not at one time, but at all times, and in all of the systems. So the predictions are pretty good, not to look, I mean, maybe, you can also compute what would you expect if you have active particles with some active, specific active movement. But I doubt that they could match the predictions of the observations we have. Please.
I don't understand what difference it would make, but why did you ignore the
data? Why did I ignore the?
The dead,
you mean? So we can observe them at all time, and we see them moving at all time. So I take the Brownian motion as a sign of living. So this is why we didn't take into account the dead bodies. Even though they may exist, then their number is so small that they have escaped our observations. This is why in this experimental system, we have ignored the dead. Because we don't know how many dies, the number is very small. But of course, it would be even nicer if you can make a system in which you kill them at some rate, and then you are able to just remove the dead. I mean, you have to remove the dead bodies for the image analysis program just to. But if you find a way of doing that, yeah, it would be perfect. Yeah, I mean, it would make the experiment even better, and you can do much more. I mean, you can make niches and migration into niches and so on. This, all the possibilities of this model we haven't explored yet, but. Oh, they're not plated at all. I mean, so this is a petri dish, pure plastic. So at the beginning, you just take the Dieterstellian and you put them on the randomly through your liquid on your petri dish, and you do it so randomly that at the beginning, you measure the variance over the mean, and at the beginning, the variance over the mean is exactly one. But you're right. I mean, if you begin with a higher patchiness, okay. That would be your beginning, and then you would grow from the patches to the other side. But all of the experimental conditions here are, and this is what we have to be careful, they all begin with balance exactly equal to one.
I do not understand much, but the fact is, from experimental point of view, we look at this equation, it really tends to grow in patches depending on what kind of petri dishes are being used. Let me show that.
I agree with you. I mean, here we are
I don't understand how to call it or whatever, but I'm just saying, this is what we generally see. Wherever you see those patches too much.
So what you see by patches is this, is the Dieterstellian sticking to each other. So here, they never stick to each other. There's always a lot of distances between the Dieterstellian. In fact, we stop the experiment when the density gets too high, just to avoid this kind of difficulties. So all of these Dieterstelliums you see have this kind of distances between them. The distance between these Dieterstelliums, in average, is much bigger than the size of the Dieterstellium. Okay. cannot make a velocity map because these are Brownian particles. So I don't know exactly what velocity means because it would depend on the time scale. But what you can measure is what we call the persistent length of the movement. And of course, these dictyostelliums have a persistent length. It's not pure Brownian, it's persistent. And the persistent time is in the range of 2 minutes. So this is what you see somewhere in one of these curves. If you look at the mean square distance as a function of time, you would see that at the beginning it doesn't begin linearly. So this is the persistent time. You can use that as a measure of speed, but we don't look more that beyond this randomness.
There's some confusion going on, I think. Do these cells have any means of self-propulsion, or are they just being kicked around?
No. They move on by themselves, but if you follow their movement is a pure Brownian. Brownian in the sense that if you measure the mean square distance as a function of time, you get this linear line.
No, but then the dead cells would also be moving.
No, as soon as you put the dictyostelium on a petri dish, they stick to the petri dish, and if they are dead, they don't move. This is how I distinguish the dead bodies from the living bodies.
They're not floating in this.
No. They just go to the bottom of the petri dish. They stick and they move on the bottom of the petri dish.
Okay,
I just try to move on to the next part of the talk because I think I spend most of my time in this part, and the next part is also could also be interesting. Okay, so that's the next part of my talk about the biodiversity. So, of course, these subjects are not totally uncorrelated, but for the moment, let's completely forget about the spatial distribution and now look at the species distribution. You now forget about anything about space. You go to an island and measure how many of these species of birds you have and how many of these species of birds you have. And this is what we call the biodiversity. This is a very famous photograph of what Darwin was observing about the finches of Galapagos. I took it as a decoration of my talk. But again, people are looking for patterns in the biodiversity of their species. What, for example, they are looking at is what's the number of species in an area as a function of the size of the area. So this is one very famous law, or supposed to be law, that's the relation between the number of species you have in an area and the size of area is a power law. If you put them on a log scale, both of them, you get some kind of lines. And they have done on many species, and this is one of the general law you would see in a classical ecological textbook, even though, as a physicist, if some of you are physicists, you will be shocked to see power laws on less than a decade. But anyway, it's one of these patterns that ecologists seem to observe in nature, that as the area gets bigger, the number of species get bigger, and there is a relation that the number of species varies as the power law of the size of your area. The other very important pattern you can look at...
Those dots are observations.
Sorry?
The dots.
So, for example, yeah. This is, they go to an area of some size, and they measure the number of species they see, and then they report that as a function of scale. And you do also see, for example, for this plant, that not all the dots have the same shapes. It's because they are from different species. Again, what now I'm going to say is that when I speak about species, maybe I'm not comparing plankton to trees. I'm comparing different kinds of trees, or different kinds of bears, or different kinds of plants. What we say, species at the same trophic level. So the other pattern people have been observing for a very long time is what they call the abundance curve. You go to an area and you look, for example, you would see that some species have 2 individuals. And you count how many species have only 2 individuals, how many species have 10 individuals. And this is what we call the abundance curve, number of species having, for example, 8 individuals or 16 individuals or something like that. So these kind of patterns have been measured for a very long time. The first measurements go back to something like 1920 or 1930. And so, for example, this is a famous measurement done by Hubble, who is a very proponent an advocate of neutral theories, and he was measuring the abundance distribution for some tropical trees in different conditions. And this is the kind of curve he was measuring. And the question is, can we have very simple models to explain these kind of curves? Is there any general rules, or can we make any abstract deduction about what they should look these kind of different curves? So again, if you go back to the founding father of the new synthesis, the guy who were very important in evolution, the answer is definitely no. The two guys who are very important in the evolution are Dobzhansky and Meyer, and for them you would get speciations when you have geographic isolations. When one species of finches becomes two species of finches, it is because they have been isolated at some point, and then each of them has grown in his own island, and this is how you observe diversity. To have diversity, you have to have isolations. So these were, in fact, very influential papers, and because these guys were very important, it took a lot of time to put them into question, even though now the isolation has been extended. It's not only geographic isolation. They can also use term of niche isolation. For example, this species of finch is going to eat this kind of worms, and this species of finch is going to eat this kind of worms. So basically what I'm saying is that for these people, again, to have speciations, you have to have geographic isolations or niche specializations. So you cannot find a priori any general rules, because it will depend on each species, on each part of the world you are looking at. So one landmark paper in ecology was this paper by MacArthur and Wilson. So this was published 50 years ago. And what they did many people were looking at the distribution of species in islands. Islands are very nice observational tools because they are small, they are isolated. You can think of something to say about the island before going to the continent. So there have been a huge amount of work done on the islands. And what people knew about the island is that, first of all, the number of species in small islands is smaller than the number of species in big islands, everything being constant otherwise. So among similar islands, what also they would observe is that if an island is far from a continent, the island would have less species than the islands who are close to the continent. And yeah, sure, I reversed the other important fact, of course, is the number of species on the island is always much smaller than the number of species on the continent to which the island is close. So these are the observations made on many, many different islands. And MacArthur and Wilson did a very bold hypothesis at this time, which kind of shook or shocked the ecological community. They just made a very, very simple model that to explain this kind of these three facts. So they just imagine that, in fact, in islands, if you're looking at species of birds or plants, every species, all the species are similar. New species are coming from the continent, and the number of new species per unit of time coming from the continent is a decreasing function of the number of species already in the island. Because if all the species of the continent are in the island already, then of course there is no newcomer from the continent. And they also suppose that species in island die, species disappear, and more species you have, the rate of extinction of the species gets bigger. So, yeah, it's just a proportionality rule that you lose, and I'll come back to that. That was the hypothesis. But you lose, for example, 1% of your species per generation or something. So, this makes an equilibrium. When these two curves cross, you have the equilibrium number of the island on the species on the island, and with this very simple model, they could explain the three facts I said before. For example, if you are on a compare, for example, the distribution of between small and large islands, and for a given moving curve, and you'll see that they are crossing at different points. So on large island, the number of species would be bigger. So this was a kind of graphical explanation of the number of species on the island. And this, when the paper appeared in 63, it was a very, it made a huge kind of controversy, discussions, and so on. But now, of course, this model is taught in every ecological textbook, the MacArthur and Wilson theory. Even though, I mean, this is not very specific, we don't really know these rates, even though people have tried to measure this kind of curves. For example, the kind of experiment they can do, they can go to a small island in Florida, put a plastic over the island, a small island. I mean, the island is 10 meters by 10 meters, and then kill everybody in the island, and then remove the plastic and kill everybody by putting some poison. Remove the plastic and observe how species are coming back, just to be able to measure this kind of curve. So this is the kind of experiment they can sometimes do, but of course, this is just a graphical model to explain the point very well. What was very important is that Wilson and MacArthur forgot everything about the differences between the species. They took all the bird species coming to the island as similar, which is very shocking to an ecologist. I mean, classical ecologists would spend his time to study the specificity of one kind of bird compared to another one. So just putting all the birds on a similar at a similar level, it was kind of shocking. But this is you had a question. This is what was at the basis of the model, that this is a neutral model. All the species, you know, given trophic levels are similar. So you don't have to specify that this species dies more than this species. You have just to accept that everybody has kind of same rate. But so it took something like 40 years, but then people asked, why stop at the island, but not look at the continent at the same way we look at the island, by telling that all the species in a given trophic are similar, at least for what relates to the pattern of abundance distribution or so. So again, the kind of model I'm going to speak about, people in the population genetics were kind of used to. The first person, I think, doing the exact computation on that was Maleko in 48, and then, of course, Kimura made it very popular in population genetics. In ecology, it took some time to become popular, but then the book by Hubbell was published in 2001. Hubbell was a famous ecologist at this time, and the book of Hubbell, which appeared in 2001 or something, really put the neutrality hypothesis at the heart of the biodiversity at the continent and on the island. So the model, this is what I explained before, the model of Hubbell is that, again, Hubbell is a person working on trees, but the model doesn't depend on trees. It's very general for each trophic level. You have different trees, in your continent, and at some point one tree dies and it's replaced by the seed of another tree. The death rate of all the trees are similar. There's no difference between the species. The seed migration, the seed dispersal is similar. Whatever, there is no species between these different trees. And we would ask, which kind of diversity you would get if you only play this game. So the species can disappear. If you have only one individual of one species, the species, if the tree dies, the species will disappear. New species will appear because of mutations. And even though it's a totally dynamic system, different species die, different species appear, but the abundance curve is a stable curve, in fact. So, and of course, what I said about the continent, you apply the same model to the island. You just suppose that island has this particularity of also receiving some migrants from the continent. And so now the theory is called the Unified Theory of Biodiversity, UNTB, it's the name very much used. What is very nice about UNTB is that these very simple rules, random, neutral, make very straight predictions, and this is what we are going to see. First of all, what kind of prediction we can make based on this very simple facts, and do these observations have to do anything with what people do observe? So let me just first explain more precisely the continent. So on the continent you have different species. I have put them in different colors. At each time step, one individual dies, for example this one, and then randomly you get somebody from the community, for example this one, which is chosen totally at random, and its seed is going to replace this one. So this is the basic evolution model. Of course, as I said, if for example this individual dies, this species is going to disappear, and if by mutations this species replaces this one with a mutation, you have the appearance of a new species. So can we make predictions about the abundances, about the number of species? Of course, this is a totally stochastic process. If you look at the probability of having, yes?
Do you start with the same number of individuals for all species?
No, I mean, you can, but you don't have to. I mean, doesn't matter. You can begin at the totally homogeneous, so take the approximate distribution of this species at the beginning. What you do know is that all of the species, if you look at the particular species and play this game long enough, this species is going to disappear. This is just by stochastic processes. Because sometimes if everybody in the population dies, then there is no coming back. And by chance, it's assured that for long time you're sure that you would touch the zero axis or something. So
but you start with the origin.
You could. But it's totally independent of that. And what I'm going to say is that whatever the initial conditions, if we look at long times, we have forgot everything about what you put at the beginning, at what can you observe as the pattern of abundance at the long time. That's the only thing I'm going to show here. Because all the islands we are measuring now, and people have done a lot of measurements on the islands, have been the result of, if this model is true, have been the result of this game for a very long time. So the initial condition doesn't matter here, really.
By mutation, you mean the species becomes another species?
Yeah. So Hubble has been criticized a lot about what he really means by that. But yeah, let's stop to this kind of... of course, you can say that you need many mutations, accumulation of many mutations to really become a distinct species, yeah, and so on. So the rate of mutation they measure, for example, in tropical trees, if they apply this kind of model, it's extremely low compared to what we know from the actual rate of mutations. But doesn't matter exactly how many mutations you have to accumulate. The only thing we suppose that we have some mutation rate.
Yeah. So the word is being used in a different sense.
Yeah, sure. So again, if you one species appear at one individual, and then it's a stochastic movement going up, having two individuals going down by some chances, and after some times, the species which appear at one individual would reach k individuals. But of course, if you redo the game, you would get very, very different trajectories in your game. For each species beginning with one individual, the fate can be very different. And so now you can derive what we do in statistics, what's the priority for individuals to increase the number by one or decrease by one. I won't bother you with that, but it's just the very fact I said to you that somebody dies at random and gets replaced at random. And so you can write what's the probability of observing for a given species, k individual of this species at time t, you get a nice equation, which you are able to solve by the way. And but more importantly, from this quantity, you can get the abundance. What is the average number of species having k individual? And this comes back to a simple integral. I won't look at that. But this is the very crucial quantity which the neutral model is predicting. And then, if you know this quantity, of course, you know the total number of species you have, because you know all of the species you have in your system. So, in fact, all of these equations, you can solve them exactly and get some nice predictions, which are shown here, for different rate of mutations. For example, what is very important is this number, the rate of mutation multiplied by the number of people in the community, which is now called the biodiversity number. And for different biodiversity number, you can get different distribution curves. Now, let's now go to the island models. How many species you get in an island? You play the same game. But as I said, when one individual died in the island, it has a priority also of receiving a migrant from the continent. So again, you can write the same kind of equations, and now if you look at the number of species, at the abundance of the species in the island, you will see that you have, for some numbers, you have some, you can have some bumps in the middle. And this is something which has been observed. This was troubling many of ecologists. How to explain this kind of maximum which we're observing on islands and very rarely on the continent. So, and I will come to the comparison to experimental data, but since it had appeared, the model really emerged 10 years ago, and it has been, in the ecological community, it has been a subject of huge debate about who is wrong, who is right, if Hubble is specifying too much or not. What we do know is that the kind of prediction we make about the abundance of species, it's extremely well fitted in all the kind of measurements we have. So people have gone and have aggregated all the data we have on ecological communities, and you cannot imagine, for example, this data from many different communities, how many years and students and researchers can they take. These are many, many, many years of data collections. But if you look at this data, so you would see that, in fact, the neutral model is, in all of this data, is pretty well fitting the abundance curves. These abundance curves, which were seeming mysterious and different from system to system, now you can all gather them together in kind of one model. But there are other predictions of the neutral model which are not always, I'm not specialized in this other prediction, but they're not always observed. And so people are trying, for example, to make them better. This is a collection of, again, 10 data on 10 tropical forests. And people compare the predictions of the neutral models to what they should get. And they see that in half of them, the prediction is extremely good. And in half of them, the prediction is not bad. What you could complement is with just one addition, which is kind of density dependence, and then you would explain everything. So this is a very moving, I mean, the subject is moving fast. There is a lot of discussions about how to improve the models. But what we know is that at least as a first approximation, the neutral models, that all of the three species are similar, it's a very good model as a first approximation to explain this strange behavior, the patterns of biodiversity. Maybe we don't need to go to more complicated models of adaptations and this kind of thing I was speaking about. Again, I'm not saying that the neutral model is true. I'm saying that it's a very first approximation on which we have to build. It's not because we see some pattern of the biodiversity that we should be surprised. We should again compare what we get from our neutral model and then see if we have something else. Please, you had a question.
Yes.
I
want to consult. Are very close to each other, for example, but still show the same assemblage of species in the same proportions. How does this kind of
model, I don't know, as
explain
I,
that? Because, you know, you're comparing Sestina Raja to Lambi or whatever. Very, very different. So how do you explain assemblages of species which are really quite identical across very similar sizes?
So I don't know, and again, this is one of the subjects which is extremely debated in the community. Why do we forget about what you say? For example, the assembly of these species of trees should depend, for example, on the other ones, and we should know about that. What they say here, we just made some computation on this model, is that even if you forget all of that, we can make very good predictions. So, of course, these interactions are important, but maybe they're not important to explain all of the biodiversity. They are important to explain part of the biodiversity. And there's a basis which we can explain only based on neutral models. Yes?
So in the early case, when you had the little bump, so it's sort of the reasoning that the so-called mutation rate is higher?
No, it's not only mutation rate, because on the island you also have migrants coming from the continent. So sometimes there is a balance between how many species you get from the continent and how species die on the island.
So what I mean is that instead of just having replacement from mutation, you have replacement from mutation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sort of
and this is, in fact, where people have most of the data. It's on the island. So this is why these kind of conditions are important to look at on the island.
But that would also suggest that if you look at smaller areas within a larger geographical area, you would find the same kind of bump in the data?
So this is a very nice question. And I'll come to that just a little, because this is, okay, let's just answer it. We don't know. And we don't know because we cannot make predictions. In fact, you can say that the continent is just an assembly of islands with millions between these islands. So you're absolutely true, and we are not able to compute exactly how to do all of that. The only thing we can do is the very simple computation I show you by just this migration coming from the continent to the island. The next level, and this is an extremely harsh level, we were not successful to do the whole computations. We were just able to do computations between two islands which are close to each other. And even then, the competition was so hard that we just published it and didn't pursue it. So I don't know how you would predict on the whole continent these kind of patterns. The kind of model I showed you are extremely simplified, because in the continent, everybody is supposed to replace everybody else, whatever is distance. And of course, this is not true at all. So these are huge simplifications we are making here.
The reason I thought was because in the various sites, the reason might be about how much isolation you have of the site that predicts, because they should have the little bumps, was the main difference.
So you're right about that. From my point of view, what is very hard is that then you have some mathematical complications which we weren't able to go through. But you're right. But
the foundation.
So the bump is, in fact, the bump is what has been observed many times, and this is why the neutral model of the neutral model was so much popular. Because for no, you are right. You can have gaps. People try to be as much. I mean, for example, when they go to this island, as I said, they count every trees in the island up to the to this height, for example. And so this is a team of 80 persons going to an island for I don't know how many months, and they try to collect everything.
But on the continent, you don't.
So the continent, as he said, you can make small plots, and then people try to use the small plots as if it was an island. But again, these are huge simplifications. It's just because we are at this moment, at this part of the theory. And of course, I mean, I'm sure people will progress in the theory, but at this point, what I'm explaining is this is the only fact. And the prediction can be.
No, vaguely, it looks to me that both the paradigm of the theory and the matching appear to have some kind of natural distribution.
I don't know. So, for the biodiversity, people don't go to the level of what you are saying, even though they try to use something called beta diversity, which is, again, what's the. How is the correlation function between the species here and the species here? And with the other one, we didn't try to use any kind of fractal computations, because personally I'm skeptical about fractals. And I found that the statistical tools we used there is enough to describe the system. But yeah, you may be right. I mean, you may be able to measure some fractal dimensional distributions or so on. In fact, some people measuring the patchiness use this kind of box counting and for quantifying the patchiness.
What would be interesting in doing is that you could both the biodiversity as well as the policy function of the species. Do they have the same factor dimension?
Oh, I do. I mean, maybe in many, many years.
Because
people
they are covered by the same.
Yeah, but one of them is space, the other one is the species distribution, but yeah, you're right. I mean,
well, it could be time.
Yeah, you're right. So, let me just conclude that now UNTV is 10 years old. It has been successful in some part. Again, it was very shocking to try to explain the whole pattern of biodiversity with such a simple rules. But it has been somehow successful, and it's the first model which is predictable and can make some explanation of these patterns. So there are many different directions which you can progress in this way. One is that one you said, Mohin, is that make it really spatially self-consistent, consider the island, the continent as a collection of islands with migration between them, which is mathematically very hard, but I'm sure people will make progress in it. But I think can do real progress in there is that first we could design laboratory experiments as the one I showed you. And I think this is the way to go if we want to see if we can, the model is any good in a predictive way, the best way to do it is to use laboratory experiments. And the other one is to, I mean, the ecological community, the classical ecological community is far separated from the microbial ecology community. And in microbial world, people have quantification data based on DNA or these things that they can improve a lot the data collections. Instead of spending years to collect the data on the three species, they could spend much less time to collect this kind of information on the microbial distributions. So these are the area, I think, that we will progress and show some usefulness. So let me just make the whole conclusion about what I was speaking about. First, please consider that neutral models and random models are not just boring. They can have some useful predictions. And I mean, we do have a tendency toward adaptation, is that to always explain that this has been selected here because it has some benefits. Maybe before going to this adaptationist program, we should first of all begin with a neutral random theory model, just to see what this neutral model gives us, and then build up on that. But this randomness is coming from the very basic fact of life, that you duplicate and you die, and you move randomly. And these don't make homogeneous patterns. They make some kind of intricate patterns. And this has to be taken into account before looking for the deterministic process. OK, I thank you very much.
Lovely lecture.
Thank you very much. I don't have chocolates. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the neutral model is one null model with a particular set of conditions.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
And so one question is how valid are the conditions under which it's set? For instance, so the assumption it makes is of all species being equal in terms of its basic parameters. And that, from a lot of work you know, is not necessarily true. So while it's a good explanation of a pattern which has been explained through biology, if you set up the conditions differently, you're likely to. So, I mean, if you might be just finding the null model which best fits, but there is a whole.
You're absolutely right. Here, what I showed is that let's make the only basic hypothesis and see what we observe. And again, we can now make it more complicated. For example, in the first example I was showing you, maybe we can add resource limitations when these bacteria are moving. Resource limitation equal for everybody, if you want to speak about neutral models, and see what are the consequences. This has been done, for example, by numerical simulations. Mathematical is more complicated. You have to make some big approximation. But then again, you see that you have the same, the variance over the mean doesn't explode, doesn't go to infinity, but it goes to very high values. Even when you add this kind of hypothesis, and we do know that, of course, the resources are limited, you cannot grow infinitely. You are absolutely right. What I was showing is that let's begin with the very simplest thing, and then if there is some hope in this stuff, we can complicate it.
Do you have any comment on diversity within a species?
On what side?
Diversity within a species. What you have talked about, different species, right?
So what do you mean, for example, diversity between humans?
Yes, exactly. And for example, diversity in beetles.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that, for example, Kimura, back in the 70s, was supposing that most of the differences we have in humans has nothing, I mean, if you go to the north, to the Sweden, and see people with blue eyes, maybe blue eyes has no selective advantage. It's just a random mutation. So Kimura was a very proponent that most of the mutation we see or just neutral. It has been debated a lot.
But I must mention that, but that is at the molecular level. At the
people use molecular, they take blood samples from you, they do two-dimensional gels, and they try to quantify this diversity and so on. My impression was that the community, again, is divided between the proponents of the neutral model that for humans, for example, or within species that you say, most of the mutations are neutral, and people who think that no, neutrality is not that important, maybe adaptation is more important. So every month or 2 months or 3 months, you see a paper coming in favor of one or the other argument. And I can't answer. I just know that it's very debated.
Thank you.
is a wonderful lecture. See, there are a lot of functions in the ecosystem. And theoretically, the number of species can be infinite.
It cannot be bigger than the number of individuals. So if you have, for example, 1 million individuals, you cannot have more than 1 million species. That's the upper limit.
Okay, that's the upper limit. Now, why is that the extinction in the island? That's because that island is no longer suitable for that species. So it gets extinct.
So
it's replaced by another species from the mainland, which like these conditions in the island. But there's a limit to the extinction in the island. It's limited to the total number of species available in the island. And immigration from the continent, that also has a limit to the total number of species available in that continent. Now, when you say that the at the equilibrium, as per the graph, rate of extinction should be equal to the rate of immigration. But that situation cannot occur because the rate of immigration is limited to a certain extent, to the total number of individuals. But rate of extinction can go further beyond. Now, when you extrapolate it to the continent, like from Ireland, you have a scope of immigration. When you extrapolate it to the continent, again you have scope for immigration from a different continent. But again, when you extrapolate it to the whole world, there is no scope of immigration, if you believe the theory, what is prevailing here. So, in such a case, the ideal situation of rate of extinction being equal to the rate of immigration. Immigration will be now replaced by speciation when you go in a global term. If you believe it, again, if you believe in evolution. So, if the rate of speciation and rate of extinction are the same at equilibrium, the total number of species in the world will always remain the same. That is what I get from your research.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, the MacArthur and Wilson theory is not really a theory in the sense that it's not very predictive. It's just a graphical theory. So I wouldn't take it more seriously. But what I wanted to show is that even though species disappear and other species appear, there is a dynamic equilibrium which makes the size of the abundance, the abundance curve is stable. You can play this game in your computer and you would see that even though all of your species are going to disappear and new ones are appearing, very soon the shape of the abundance distribution becomes stable. It's much lower than the limits you are fixing, because very, very soon you see that there are some species, we are majority, one species will take 10% of the individuals. So the number of species you would observe, it's much below the limits you are putting at. So I don't know in the general, but I know that if you play these simple games, this is what very soon you would observe.
Did you finish? Sorry. So, I don't think that neutral and adaptive models should be actually put in competition in the sense that I think that they are important for different spatiotemporal scales you're looking at. So, for instance, I don't believe that neutral models can explain the patterns at the global scale of the plankton you were showing before, because if you want to explain a pattern at the global scale, you can't ignore the existence of gradients and currents and whatever. So, but they might explain well the distribution at a small scale, where basically you have that processes like diffusion, random diffusion, and dispersal is at play. So I think that...
So let me again stress, and this is like Lydia stressing that when he said design, he didn't mean what... Again, I'm not saying that everything is neutral or neutrality is the most important thing in the world. What I'm saying is that when you observe a pattern, don't go and look for a determinist code at the beginning. First, look what you would get from neutral and then see what you observe more. Again, let's come back to the plankton you are seeing. In fact, the plankton is one of the systems when people love to use neutral models, because now to these models of random Brownian, you can also add the ocean currents. And what you would see, and this was also in the simulation of Wright, is that even when you add oceanic currents, or any kind of deterministic current, you don't kill the patchiness. The patchiness still observed like that. So in fact, their simulation, I'm not saying that I'm a proponent of the paper, it was that even though you take into account very complicated model as oceanic simulations, the neutral model will give you huge patchiness, which is comparable to what they observe at the scale of the planet. But again,
this does not mean that it is neutral. This does not mean that the neutrality is the explanation of the patches.
So let's see what kind of prediction you can make. And more constraints you put on your model, the better you believe on your model. For example, on what I showed you on the deuterium, what I can predict is the exact histogram of the pair distributions at all the time. These are very, without any adjustable parameter, these are very precise prediction, and you can't make it out by just fitting something or not. So there are so many constraints that you have to fit all of this curve, to observe all of this curve at all different times, for all different experimental conditions, that this is what makes the model in the petri dish very good. Coming back to the model on the oceans, they don't have this kind of data. And of course, as they collect more and more of this data, they can compare it to all the prediction of neutral models, and then on top of that, build some of the physical or geographical constraints they have. But again, I'm not saying everything is neutral, it's just neutrality exists. Maybe it's important, maybe it's dominant. For that to know, we have to collect data and compare it to neutrality. But maybe you're right, maybe we are much beyond what neutrality can explain for the plankton. I mean, the plankton is one of the systems people love to cite when they speak about neutrality. But many other systems, it's very debated when they look at the diversity of the coral reef, for example. This is one of the examples where they were showing that neutrality is not useful. That the patchiness cannot be explained by what you get from neutrality.
Kinds of conditions, what do we see? It's like, because one would expect the pattern to be more dynamic at places having extreme conditions?
I mean, very soon, whatever the rate of mutations and the rate of migration or so on, the pattern of abundance stabilizes pretty much. The pattern is different. The pattern has two parameters, the biodiversity number and the migration number. So you have different shape of this pattern based on these two parameters. But once you have these two parameters, the pattern itself is stable. Even though, for example, you have high mutation rate, you would have high extinction, high apparition, and so on. But the pattern itself very soon becomes stable. Again, you're not looking at this species or this species or this species. You forget about their differences. You just say, how many species I have which have 1,000 individuals? How many species I have who has 500 individuals? And this you call pattern of abundance.
What about the environmental conditions?
So again, we come back to that. I mean, what's the importance of environment? And I mean, the diversity neutral theory has appeared 10 years ago, and people are collecting data in favor and against it. And I think if we just look at the classical ecological community of trees and mammals and so on, we're not going to go far because the lifetime is so long that, I mean, we cannot do a good data collection. The way to go for this kind of theory is to go to microbial system, and I hope that in 10 years, 5 years, we'll have much more data to see how much we can agree or not with the neutral models. But again, I mean, a lot of you are shocked about this neutral because we are forgetting everything about environment, difference between species and so on. And I know it's a shocking hypothesis, but what I'm saying is that first let's look at what this hypothesis gives us and then build upon that. That's it.
Yes, sir.
Continue this